electronics technician. I'll give you a ring. Okay, we're still on the failure of atheistic arguments. We've already discussed the problem of evil and the information that came before it. I want to talk a little bit about Anthony Flew, the British agnostic, one of the world's leading philosophers, who one of my professors, Gary Habermas, debated on the resurrection. Oh, what am I talking about? I'm looking down at Anthony Flew. No, we want to cover Albert Camus first. Man, I'm getting way ahead of myself. One of our cassettes is not cooperating. Okay, let's take a look at Albert Camus, the French existentialist. Remember, an existentialist believes that there is no God. This is a secular existentialist. You'll get your religious existentialist. Don't ask me why, Rudolf Bultmann, Karl Barth, but the secular existentialist is a man who denies the existence of God and then recognizes since there is no God, there's no objective meaning to life, so life is absurd. And some existentialists are pessimistic and realizing that life is absurd. Others are optimistic and they take a leap of blind faith and through non-reason, they take a leap of blind faith and create some meaning for their lives. So, which is, I don't know why they would do it, but Albert Camus was a French existentialist, a friend of Jean-Paul Sartre. He wrote a book entitled The Plague, a novel, and it talked about man's dilemma. He wrote about a city where there was a plague of rats, and the rats went around spreading a disease, and people were dropping off like flies and dying. And the problem was that the atheist doctor, or at least agnostic doctor, he was going around trying to heal people and fighting the plague, but the priest couldn't fight the plague because the priest recognized that God allowed the plague. Now, even some of my professors at Liberty would argue that Camus arguing that God made the plague come about. God brought the plague about. He directly sent the plague, and therefore Camus is arguing to fight the plague is to fight God. That's not what Camus is arguing. Camus is just arguing that the Christian is saying that God allows anything that happens, God allowed it for a purpose of a greater good. But if God allowed it for a purpose of a greater good, then for us to try to stop that, we would be fighting God and whatever that greater good would be for God allowing it. So God allowed the plague. To fight the plague is to fight God. Therefore, to be religious, one must be anti-humanitarian. So Camus isn't arguing that I'm proving God's existence false. What he's saying is, if you are a Christian, you shouldn't help your fellow man because God allowed your fellow man to be in the sad state that he's in for the purpose of a greater good. But if you're an atheist, then you can go out there and fight the plague. Now, the Christian response is that basically the plague, evil and human suffering, is basically sin, okay? And God is allowed the plague of sin for a greater good, human free will, and some of the results that come from it. At the same time, God is fighting the plague of sin and its effects, and so the godly man will fight it also. In fact, I would argue that this is part of the greater good that God brings out of allowing evil and human suffering. Part of that greater good is that people who love the Lord are going to be called to do works of charity and works that would help others. So when Christians are out there feeding the hungry and building hospitals and that type of thing, they're actually fulfilling part of that greater good that God wanted to bring about by allowing the plague. Also, the other side of that coin is if a guy does not believe that God exists, or believes that if God exists, there's no way for man to know. In other words, if a man's an atheist or an agnostic, you've got no basis to help out your fellow man. Sure, you might you know, in other words, if Camus wants to take a leap of blind faith and self-actualize himself, self-authenticate himself by creating meaning for his life by helping his fellow man, well, big deal. Maybe Adolf Hitler wants to actualize himself in a different area. It's just like Jean-Paul Sartre said, when an old lady's crossing the street, whether you help her across the street or whether you mug her, it makes no difference at all from an atheistic existentialist standpoint, as long as you actualize yourself and do something. So it's irrelevant whether you're going to fight the plague or massacre people.
Because there are physiology of the grounded objectivism.
Well, it goes even beyond that. Their moral judgments aren't grounded objectively. So their moral judgments are leaps of faith. There's no basis. If there is no all-good God who has determined what is right and what is wrong for man, then anything goes. If it feels good, do it. And so the atheist has no consistent way within his worldview to call the actions of Adolf Hitler evil. Even Immanuel Kant, who was seen so much as an enemy of historic Christianity, and he is, even he argued that though you couldn't prove God's existence through pure reason, practical reason demands that God exists. We have to posit or assume God's existence just to make sense out of our moral life. He said that if there is no God and no life after death and judgment, then it doesn't matter what you do. But if we really try to live in a universe where it didn't matter what we did, we'd all kill ourselves off. So Camus' argument actually backfires on him. But keep in mind, Camus is not arguing that God directly brought the plague, but just the fact that God allows the plague for the purpose of a greater good. The fact of the matter is, God could have prevented it. So his argument has as much thrust as if God directly brought it, but he's only arguing that God allowed it. And the next atheistic argument, the argument from contradictory attributes. In this, what they'll do is they'll take the Christian concept of God and they'll say, well, let's just assume that your Christian God exists. If he exists, you tell me that he has this attribute and then he has this other attribute. Well, guess what? It's a contradiction to say that he has both of those attributes. And so that's how the argument runs. It doesn't really disprove the existence of God. These arguments are supposed to disprove the existence of the Christian God. So you've either got to give up this attribute over here or that attribute over there. For instance, like the problem of evil. You could put that in this same classification, because maybe God's not all-powerful. Maybe he's all good, but he's not all-powerful, so he couldn't prevent evil. But then again, maybe he's all good. Maybe he's all powerful, but he's not all good. So he could have prevented it, but he didn't want to. And so Christians, they try to force Christians to take one horn of the dilemma or the other, which gives you something less than the Christian God. But in actuality, there usually is a way out. Well, there always is a way out when they try to show that the God of the Bible is contradictory. We'll just give two examples here. First argument goes as follows. An all-powerful God can do anything, even create a rock that he cannot lift. But if he can't lift this rock, he's not all-powerful. Therefore, no all-powerful God exists. That's the way the argument usually runs. Response to this, we need to recognize that the definition that the atheist is using here for all-powerful, omnipotence, is kind of a third-grade definition. It's not a fine-tuned definition. Christians get their definition of what all-powerful means from the Bible. And the Bible does say that God can't do a lot of all things. So in response, number one, God is all-powerful, but there are things that even he, an all-powerful being, cannot do. For instance, if God is all-powerful, then that means that he can accomplish anything he sets out to accomplish, which means he can't fail. If God is all-powerful, we need to recognize he's also all-good. Therefore, he can't rebel against himself. He can't sin. The Bible says he can't lie. The Bible says he can't change his mind. He can't make a mistake and then change his mind and try to correct it later. So even though God is all-powerful, there are things that even an all-powerful being cannot do. Point number two, God cannot do what is impossible by nature. In other words, he can't create square circles. God can do things that are impossible for man, and he can do things that are impossible for angels, but there are things that are impossible by definition. God cannot create a man who is also a non-man in the same way and at the same time, okay? That's a contradiction. He can't create square circles. There is no such thing. Also, I would add, too, whatever God can do must be consistent with his good nature. So things like sinning, lying, changing his mind, things of that sort God would not be able to do because it would contradict his nature, and then also things that are impossible by definition. Now, whatever God creates, he's able to master. Lucifer may believe that he is the rock that God created that God can't master, but the fact of the matter is if God created it, he'll always be able to master it. He can create a rock of tremendous size, but as its creator, he will always be able to lift it. So the problem here in this first argument is there's a faulty definition being used of all-powerful. By all-powerful means that God can do anything, even things that are logically impossible and even things that contradict his good nature, when in actuality, all-powerful means that God is not limited by any other being. He can do anything that he sets out to do, but he cannot do that which is impossible by definition or anything that would contradict his good nature. Second argument goes as follows. Either something is good because God wills it, but then good is arbitrary, you know, because God just went eeny, meeny, miny, mo. I decided that in this universe I created, I randomly and arbitrarily decided that killing innocent babies is evil and feeding the hungry is good. Well, if that was a total, if it's good just because God decided it was good, just because God willed it, then good is arbitrary, okay? Or God willed it because it is good. But then the standard of good is above God. In other words, God said, I'm going to will that people not kill, I'm going to make a commandment that they not kill innocent people because it's wrong to kill innocent people. But see, then the standard of good seems to be above God. So therefore, either good is arbitrary, and the Christian wouldn't want to accept that. We want to say what God calls good is good, and not just because God calls it good, but because it is good. But the Christian wouldn't want to call good arbitrary, nor would he want to say that there's a standard. Good is a standard above God. But the response here is as follows. Point number one, God wills it because it is consistent with his own good nature. You see? He doesn't just will it and then it's good, it becomes good arbitrarily, but he wills it because it's consistent with his own good nature. So it's not arbitrary, but then also the standard is not above God or arbitrary because God himself is the standard. Just as we say God is love, we can also say God is good. And so God is the standard. The standard is not above God, nor is good arbitrary. I think what I'm going to do, I'm going to finish this section on the failure of atheistic arguments and then open it up to questions, and if you have any questions, we can cover them at that point. Anthony Flew, I started talking about him earlier, I was just rambling on. Anthony Flew, a British philosopher and agnostic, he talks about two guys walk into a wilderness, and they find this beautiful garden in the midst of the wilderness. And the believer says, well, there must be a garden. And the non-believer says, no, there's no gardener. It just randomly grew here, you know, by chance. And So they argued out, and they decided, well, what we'll do is we'll camp out here, and we'll wait and see if this gardener comes and waters the plants. And so they wait, and no gardener comes. So the non-believer says, well, that proves it. There is no gardener. And the believer says, yeah, there's a gardener, but he's invisible. And so then the non-believer says, okay, well, if you think he's invisible, let's surround this area with a fence. We'll make it one of those electrical fences that'll give him a shock if he tries to climb in. And we'll have bloodhounds who can maybe, you know, catch his scent. And they do all these things, but it turns out they still can't detect this invisible gardener. And so eventually the non-believer says, well, this proves it. There is no gardener. And the believer says, no, there's an invisible gardener, but he cannot be tested with the five senses. There's no way to detect him with the five senses. And so the non-believer says, well, what's the difference between your invisible gardener and no gardener at all? Okay, and it sounds like a pretty tough argument against Christianity, because there's no way to falsify the invisible gardener. But there's many problems with this particular thing. Now, Christians don't claim that God is invisible because we never found the physical God hanging out somewhere on a planet or something. The cosmological argument would demand that he be immaterial. And so we don't flee there. We go there because that's where reason takes us. That's number one. But number two, this argument fails to admit the possibility of fulfilled prophecies, eyewitness miracles, and the resurrection of Christ from the dead. You see, the invisible God has become visible in the person of Jesus Christ. And he was performing miracles to prove his claims to be God. And those who rejected him said, you know, give us a sign of your authority. And he said, well, kill me, and in 3 days I'll rise from the dead. And so here's Anthony Flew, who said, well, there's no way to falsify, you know. And by the way, Robert Gentry, the guy who did the polonium halos, he found these polonium halos in rocks, which basically proves that the rocks were created almost instantaneously rather than taking millions of years to evolve. And it would totally destroy the evolutionary model if he's right. But he recognized for a scientific theory to be correct, for a scientific theory to hold water, there's got to be a possible way to falsify it. See, science, by definition, deals with examining things and experimentation through the five senses, okay? And so what Gentry has done is not only has he made a strong case for his view, but he's shown what has to be done in the lab to falsify his view. If you can do that in the lab, you've proven his theory false. Well, it sounds real good. And in a modern scientific age where we got so much emphasis on modern science, falsification, anytime you come up with a scientific theory, if it can't be falsified, if there's no way to falsify it in the lab, then there's no way it can be accepted as a scientific theory, because what you're saying is,
well, that's no longer true. Dark matter has become a mainstay in astrophysics, and dark matter is defined as matter which cannot be seen, detected.
Yeah, but see, there, then that wouldn't be the scientific theory. That would be a scientific model, then.
Because it's being accepted throughout the scientific community, which is supposed to be.
Well, even the Big Bang, but the Big Bang is even a model as well. It's a singular event. Maybe I should have been more specific. The scientific, by the way, we're going to get into that in the next lecture, the scientific method and all, but the scientific method starts with observation. And in fact, look at creation science. We'll see where Flu comes in here on page 8P7.2, the scientific method. Scientific method, by the way, what John's talking about, there are aspects of science that the scientific method doesn't really apply to, okay? But for something to use the scientific method for something, you'd have to, it starts with observation, then you propose a question or a problem, then you come up with a hypothesis, an educated guess, and then you have some experimentation, then you come up with a theory, which is a hypothesis with a high degree of probability. If it gets accepted on a, shown to be valid on a universal scale, or accepted as such, it becomes a natural law. But basically, when you're taking an educated guess, you're going to make some predictions. You're going to say, I've observed this, and I see the problem, and now here's the solution. Here's my proposed solution. And if my proposed solution is right, A is going to happen. But if B or C happens, then we know my proposed solution was false. Okay? Now, if A happens and B and C don't happen, it looks real good for you, okay? But the fact is, there was a way through the five senses to prove your scientific theory false if, in fact, it could be proven false through the five senses. So, Plew's argument sounds real good because falsification is a real big thing right now. There's a big emphasis on it with all this love for the scientific method. But the fact remains that there are some things that cannot be proven through the five senses, and we accept them as true. I think Plew's falsification principle eventually would cave in to just another, I think Terry Almisi, another one of my professors from Liberty, when he debated him on God's existence, I think he was correct that ultimately Plew's falsification principle doesn't sound much different than A.J. Ayer's verification principle, which starts out with the premise, truth, something is true only in two cases. Either one is true by definition, or two, we can prove it true by the five senses. And that's not necessarily the case. But I don't think there's much problem. Could Christianity have been falsified?
Yeah, if we found Jesus' body.
Right. If the Romans had produced the rotting corpse of Christ, it could have been falsified. If people could have found out talking to the man born blind and found out that it was just a big hoax, and this really wasn't the blind guy. There was a lot of different ways. Christianity is not something that hides, runs in a corner and hides. This happened right downtown Jerusalem. All this stuff was going on, and Jesus walked among them and performed miracles. And his claims, rather than his claims being falsified, the church grew in leaps and bounds. Yeah.
You reject all metaphysics then?
Anthony Plew isn't as I don't believe he's a logical positivist, and that would be A.J. Ayer. But what he's done is he's brought in a principle, the falsification principle. And so what Meathy told him during the debate was that, hey, this sounds a lot like the verification principle. And Plew kept saying, no, it's not the verification principle, because he knew that had gotten shot down. But and they kept going back and forth on it. I'm not saying it's identical to the verificational principle, but it is so closely related that in the end, what Plew's saying is, I'll only accept God's existence if I can see him, feel him, touch him, hear him, you know, running down the line. And again, you know, we're getting right back. If there's an infinite number of white ping pong balls and one red one, and if you found the red one, you could say, I've experienced the red ping pong ball. There is a red ping pong ball. But if all you found was white ones and you never found the red one, you still couldn't infallibly say there is no red ping pong ball until you've examined an infinite number of ping pong balls, which is impossible. Yeah.
So what are you saying, that God has to objectively exist in the game of existence, which is a contradiction?
He's really not arguing that God definitely doesn't exist. What he's arguing, he's saying, look, you Christians say he exists, and then you say you can prove it. Well, where's the evidence? I can't see him, I can't hear him. You know, so he's basically, It's more of a show me type argument. If you say he exists, show me. Give me some evidence, and this is the type of evidence that I'm looking for. And then he debates Gary Habermas, one of my professors from Liberty, on the resurrection of Christ from the dead. Well, there was Flew's chance. He could have shown, you know, Habermas, and said, hey, look, there's no way to falsify you there. You're not presenting any evidence at all. And but in the end of the debate, even Flew admits he got blown away. So they made a book out of it, Did Jesus Rise? The Resurrection Debate. I think it was published by Harper and Row. And they had 10 different philosophers from different worldviews. And 7 of them said Habermas won. 2 called it a draw, and 1 called it gave it to Flew. And but it was fairly obvious that even if you just accept what Flew said about the debate, it was fairly obvious that Flew knew he didn't do too well. But you know, Flew's whole stance there really is, in my worldview, miracles are not possible because I don't believe that God exists. Habermas was saying, well, a miracle did occur. Jesus did rise from the dead. Therefore, you need to change your worldview. And Habermas admitted that, you know, an argument about the resurrection is on the kind of the outer layer. And you really need to debate worldviews first. But, you know, they couldn't stay there and debate forever, so they got to get right down to it. But Habermas argued there's good arguments for God's existence, so there's good reasons for accepting this as a theistic universe, and then he gave historical evidence for Christ rising from the dead, which Flew failed to deal with. He did not offer a plausible explanation to explain the historical evidence that Habermas presented. Instead, he said, well, yeah, he pretty much said, yeah, it sounds like a resurrection occurred. At the same time, we all know that resurrections and miracles don't happen. It just doesn't fit into my worldview. Therefore, it couldn't have happened. So something happened. We don't know what, but we know it wasn't a resurrection. Well, that doesn't hold much water. What he's basically saying is, I've ruled out resurrections before I've examined the evidence. I can't explain the evidence. But since I've already ruled out a resurrection, it couldn't have happened. Well, that's arguing in a circle. The absurdity of life without God. This is actually an argument for God's existence, and it's a lot like Van Til's transcendental argument. Arguing that if God does not exist, then life has no meaning, there's no objective moral values, no such thing as right and wrong, no life after death, no rewards or punishments, and no defeat of evil that will be guaranteed. So basically, all life would be absurd if God does not exist. Yeah?
It seems to me this is a lot of the reason why there's so much fuel sacrifice. God sooner or later, why suffer all that?
Yeah. If God is who he claims he is, if he is the one that we really thirst for, the only one who can really meet our ultimate needs, then it would seem to me that a society that turns its back more and more on that God, suicide would become more and more frequent. And we're living in a society, you know, we teach our kids there's no God. We evolved from apes. There's no meaning to life. Now study hard and try to get good grades. And you know, after a while, generation goes by after generation, and eventually the kids just decide, well, why? If there's no meaning to life, if there's no God, why don't I just live from one thrill to another thrill? And then, God forbid, the kid gets one, you know, just gets 24 hours in between thrills, because then he's got to sit down and think about a life void of meaning, and suicide is almost inevitable. But the absurdity of life without God, you know, if God does not exist, explain how life has meaning. I haven't heard anybody ever present. I even think if Jesus Christ wasn't who he claimed to be, makes sense out of history. I don't think history makes much. I think the closest. The closest you can get to making sense that I've ever heard were either a kind of a religious view of evolution, where we're evolving and we're getting better and better, and it sounds real good, but then when you look at human history, it seems like the exact opposite is occurring, or a Hindu-type view, reincarnation. At least these guys are making an attempt to really make some meaning out of life. And I think those are two pretty good human attempts, but it really doesn't. It really doesn't do a good enough job because the consistent Hindu, if you're suffering, he's going to just leave you there and let you suffer. Because if he helps you out, then you've got to be reincarnated because you didn't suffer and get rid of that karma, that negative karma. And so again, those pseudo meaning, if you give that type of pseudo meaning to life, it really doesn't encourage anybody to go out there and love their neighbor. But the absurdity of life without God, I think it's something. You know, the existentialist. Would all atheists, let me ask you this, would all atheists reject that premise, the absurdity of life without God? No. The existentialists, that's where they start. There is no God and life is absurd. Therefore, we either wallow in despair or we take a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm and create meaning for our lives. But, you know, if there's no objective being who is the essence of goodness, then there's no standard, no objective standard for morality to make any sense. So you got no meaning to life, no objective morality, no judgment, no defeat of evil, and I don't think there's any reason why an Adolf Hitler... Why we could tell Adolf Hitler that he shouldn't have done what he did if there's no God. I mean, if there's no God, then whatever is good. Greg Bonson puts it this way. He said that there's no way you can get moral values from molecules in motion. And that's what an atheist defines man as. That's what an atheist defines nature. The atheistic definition between man, a cow, and a rock, his definition of those three things isn't really much different. I mean, the only difference is in degree. And I think it's pretty much a given that life is absurd without God. Now, some atheists, the humanists, secular humanists, would try to argue against it, but I don't think they have any ground to stand on. The real problem with atheists, as we mentioned earlier, is not the intellect, it's not the mind. The real problem is moralists, the will. I want to read a couple of verses from Paul in Romans 1, and then a passage from the Gospel of John. Romans 1, verses 18 to 22, Paul says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes, His eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools." But if Paul makes it real clear that the invisible God has revealed His existence and His power to man through that which is visible, the visible work of His hands. Therefore, man is without excuse. In other words, when Bertrand Russell said, they said it, if you die, and he did die, or when you die, if you meet God, what would you tell him? And he said, well, I would say that, you know, he didn't give me enough evidence. Well, if Paul is right, Bertrand Russell had enough evidence. If Paul is right, every man has enough, every man and every woman has enough evidence. And so the problem is not of the mind, it's not intellectual, it's a moral problem. Man does not want God to exist, so he suppresses that truth. As Paul says, he suppresses that truth and unrighteousness in Romans 1:18. Now look at the Gospel of John. There are those who suppress the truth, and John talks about them in John 3, but there are also those who practice the truth, those who accept whatever truth God gives them through the lesser lights of creation and conscience as God draws them to the greater light, the Lord Jesus Christ. John chapter 3, verses 19 to 21, and this is the judgment that the light, that's Christ, is come into the world, and men love the darkness rather than the light, for their deeds were evil. For everyone who does evil hates the light, and does not come to the light, lest his deeds should be exposed. But he who practices the truth comes to the light, that his deeds may be manifested as having been wrought in God. So, he who practices the truth comes to the light, comes to Christ. So the one that doesn't come to the light is the one that Paul talks about, the one who suppresses the truth. And the one who suppresses the truth hates the light and doesn't come to the light lest his deeds should be exposed.
That's what I was going to say. The reason the atheists deny God is because they don't want their deeds to be known or for them to answer for what they do.
Yeah. It's like Michael Martin gave a whole list of atheists that he thought lived moral lies, and he thought that was refuting the Christian. He was setting up a straw man argument. Because the Christians never argue you can't be moral if you're an atheist. The Christian argues you can't be moral and be consistent with your atheism. Okay? Anybody can be living consistent with their worldview. The fact of the matter is, they don't want their deeds being... But Michael Martin gives a list of guys, and one of the guys was a known adulterer. I mean, this wasn't a one-time mistake or a sin that he did once in a while. This was like his regular way of life, was he was unfaithful to his wife, or wives, plural, I don't know. And, you know, but if this guy admits the God of the Bible exists, then he's got to admit that what he's doing is sin there. So no, they do not want it exposed as sin. See, and what I listed here was man's two greatest drives, his thirst for God, which I call transcendence. Everybody, even atheists, Walter Kaufman, the atheist who edited the Portable Nietzsche, Friedrich Nietzsche's basic works, Kaufman refers to man in the preface to that work as the God-intoxicated ape. He not only admits that man is inherently religious, but he sees that as what makes the difference between man and ape. So, but this is an atheist. Sartre talked about how he had a strong desire to want to be God. Many others, they expressed it in different ways, but for the most part, it's transcendence. Mike Tyson wants to be the heavyweight champ of the world. Finally, he gets his wish, and he finds out it's not all it was perked up to be. Then all of a sudden, he starts getting himself in a whole lot of trouble. And so often, people make something their God, and then when they achieve that, they find out that the joy that they thought that they would receive isn't there. And Karl Marx, another atheist, he wanted to transcend the economic struggles of his day and achieve utopia on earth, a classless society. But there's always something that transcends man that he goes for, and he can't figure out exactly what it is, but he knows it's just beyond his reach. But that transcendent element is a religious element, and it demands man's ultimate concern. It demands man's ultimate attention. And so man has two great drives. One is for transcendence, which I believe is his thirst for God. Atheists would describe it in different ways. But man's transcendence, his thirst for God, and a drive for autonomy, his desire to be his own God. So it's the essence of free will. We have a thirst for God. God built that into man. But we also have a desire to be our own boss. So in one sense, we want God. But in another sense, we don't want him, because then we got to get with his program, not our own.
That was sin brought into the world? Is that it? Or was that inherent in man when he was created?
And I haven't done enough research on it to say that this is my dogmatic position, so I'm open to discussion on this both now and in the future. I believe that man being created with free will means there's the possibility to do evil, which means God created man with at least the possibility to desire to be his own king. Now, once that possibility was actualized, and man did decide he wanted to be his own God, his own king, then we inherited from Adam a natural tendency away from God and just looking out for ourselves, period, type of thing. You know, so basically we inherited that sin nature, but I believe even in man's created state, there is the possibility of serving God or serving self. And so we see at least something that could be called a drive for transcendence and a drive for autonomy. Now, the crazy thing is, too, is that those who favor their thirst for God, the transcendence aspect, and decide, I'm going to seek God with all my heart, even though deep down I want to be my own king, I'm going to come off the throne of my life and seek God with all my heart. Eventually, what do they get? Eventually, they get a throne. They reign with Christ for 1,000 years. But those who decide, no, I want to be my own God, I'm going to just, even though deep down inside I know God exists, I'm going to suppress that truth. I want to be my own God. They're never going to have their thirst for God quenched, and they're never going to get a throne either. So it is kind of, you either get them both or you lose them both. Now, you don't become your own God, but you do get to reign with Christ if you do trust in him for salvation. So, but that's keep in mind, I do not believe, by the way, that if you took an atheist like Bertrand Russell and made him take a lie detector test, that he would, and if you asked him, you know, when he was still breathing, if you asked him, do you believe that God exists? And he says, he would respond, no, I don't believe that, he would fail that lie detector test. And in fact, Greg Bonson's doctoral dissertation was on self-deception, how the easiest person to fool with our lies is ourselves. You know, we're the most gullible. When it comes to our story, you know, as soon as you mess up, you convince yourself it wasn't your fault and it was somebody else's fault. And you may not be able to convince anybody else on earth, but you're convinced you didn't do it. And it scares me, because sometimes I think, okay, with like the O.J. Simpson trial and stuff like that, my own gut feeling, yeah, I don't think innocent men run from the police. There's another factor there. John, would you stay outside until this one illustration is complete? No. What do you call it? I think it's even possible that a guy in O.J. Simpson's situation, I don't think O.J. has reached that point, but I think it is possible that a guy could lie to himself over a period of a year or so and convince himself and pass a lie detector test that he hasn't killed somebody.
A common tool for the self-help books is for you to, you know, kind of lose weight. You lie to yourself, I'm thin, I'm thin, I'm thin.
Yeah.
I'm not hungry. And after you've done this for yourself for a year, it might self-actualize and become true. Yeah.
Yeah. See, and there's a thin line there between the churches that got opposite extremes. We did just a total pessimistic view, or we got guys that are acting more like New Agers. And you don't speak into existence things that are not, and all that New Age garbage. At the same time, if you're not confident that you're able to achieve something, well, chances are you're not going to achieve it. So at times we do need to tell ourselves, hey, I've been working hard at this, and if I continue to work hard, I can get this thing accomplished by the grace of God, and with hard work, I believe God's called me to do is I can get it done. But there's a thin line between that, building confidence, and just calling things, saying something that you know is a straight out lie, and lying to yourself, trying to create your own. It deals with visualization, positive confession, and it's straight from the mind science cults but it is something that, is it effective? You bet it's effective. Will it help people build successful businesses? You bet it will. But does that make it right? Not necessarily. And in that particular case, I think what you've got is something that at the very least is arrogant, James would call arrogant in James chapter 4, and at the very most it's occultic. Man, I thought we had more time.